This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the Daily Digest on The Big Picture with Tina Camilla Kelly-Anissa and Lim Su. And if you've just joined us, we were talking about our local fruits earlier. Now, though, we're moving on to things that make us go ick.
Which is why we're asking you on Twitter which of these grosses you out the most. So 40% of you voted for hair in the drain trap, so I can definitely agree with that. The next is 33% with slimy things, 24% of you don't like images of holes, and 4% of you are not fans of words like moist. So you can continue to take that poll or also tweet us your thoughts at BFM Radio. You can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or you can also call us at 0377-332900.
So why do some of us feel grossed out, disgusted or even fear certain things that are usually harmless? So before we explore that, let me just explain what inspired today's story. So the BBC recently released an article on how Spanish slugs have turned out in central Moscow. So this creatures appeared to be giants compared to regular slugs, and they are orange in colour. So they can be found to be up to 15 centimetres long, and, you know, I couldn't look at these pictures without squirming.
Even just hearing about it.
Spanish slugs.
Gosh. Don't be racist.
So it was that reaction to those pictures, and, you know, not just from me, but from my colleagues, that led to the bigger question, and that is, what is the science behind why certain things bring out a disgusted reaction from some of us?
Yeah, so for example, if we see moldy bread, right, or rotting food, most of us would find that disgusting. And those are somewhat universal standards for what is quite gross to people. But it doesn't have that feeling that perhaps makes your skin crawl, or we don't react in a similar way when we see cockroaches or snails or slugs or when some people hear the word moist.
Yeah, or, you know, on my personal favourite, the disgust you get looking at a cluster of holes or bumps, you know, or better known as trypophobia. So, you know, just to jog everyone's memory, examples of common triggers of this phobia are lotus seed pods, tiny foams on your drink, or Killmonger's body from the film Black Panther.
Aww.
I know, that was very confusing for me.
Did you like... Okay, so you have trypophobia or mild trypophobia?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
So when you see a Killmonger, were you turned off? Or, because he's pretty...
Yeah,
he's a looker.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I was telling to Shawik yesterday. I said... he's very attractive, but I just couldn't... I didn't know what to do when I saw that. It's like, keep your shirt on.
But is that different? Because that's not exactly holes, isn't it? It's bumps.
Yeah, so trypophobia also does include bumps. Mm. So it's that cluster of bumps and holes. So to understand the psychological fear, you know, part of this better, here is a clip from a show we did a while back on the evolution of disgust with Paul Rosen, a psychologist.
When we talk about disgust in a psychological sense, is there anything, you know, added to that we don't understand? Because I think most of us would know basically what disgust is. But from an academic psychological point of view, is there more to it than what we might basically understand as basic disgust?
I would say yes, because the word as it's used in American English, I'm not sure about British English, but in American English, it's mostly about bad. It's used to mean bad. So you say something is disgusting, you really mean it's bad. And there is a scale, one of the scales to measure disgust sensitivity says, you know, how disgusting is X? And if you say how bad is X, you get a very similar score. So that's a very loose use of the word. We don't use it that way in psychology. It's much more focused, and we try to distinguish things that are disgusting versus just bad, or disgusting versus angering, because many things that are offensive anger you and disgust you. So in terms of the food side, most things about food properties are more disgusting than anything else. When you say it's bad, you usually mean it's disgusting, though you could mean it tastes bad. And things that taste bad are usually not disgusting. They're bitter or something. And, you know, nobody thinks that beer, who doesn't like beer, thinks it's really disgusting. So one criteria we have used, not everyone accepts this, is that if something is disgusting, if it touches something you like, it renders it inedible. So, for example, if a cockroach touches your favorite food, you won't eat it. But if you don't like beer and a little beer touches it, or if you don't like spinach and a little piece of spinach touches it, you'll still eat it. All right, so disgust is a particular kind of powerful way of expressing a food rejection.
And when, I mean, in the article, they cited Valerie Curtis, who believes that disgust kind of has this function of helping us basically avoid disease, stay healthy. In your opinion, what is the function of disgust in our lives? Where did it come from? When does it develop? Because it seems quite, it seems like a very uniquely human feeling or concern.
Yeah, well, I would say that disgust is uniquely human. And one reason for that is that this idea of contamination, that when something disgusting touches something, it makes it inedible, that's only present in humans. But Valerie Curtis's argument is that disgust originates as a biological adaptation to avoid pathogens. And it certainly functions. There's no question that disgust operates to avoid pathogens, and she's one of the main people who provided most theory of the evidence for that. But the question is that all, there are two questions about that claim. One is it biologically evolved as opposed to culturally evolved? And the second question is that how much of disgust as it actually occurs is accounted for by pathogen avoidance? So there's no doubt that it accomplishes pathogen avoidance. And there's no doubt that it seems to be pretty universal in humans, but not until the ages of 4 or 5 years of age. So it still could be built in by our genes, or it could be acquired, and we don't really know that yet. But whatever it is, it certainly functions at some level to avoid pathogens. The question is, how far can you push that? So when you say something is disgusting, and you really mean disgusting as opposed to just bad, how much of that can be accounted for? So if you say incest is disgusting, and incest is something that is definitely more disgusting than angering. So it's not just that it's bad. It scores most on disgust. Is that basically an issue of pathogen passing through mating with a related person? Seems to me unlikely. It's more about, it depends how you look at it, but it's certainly more about a mating disadvantage because of the frequency of defects in children of related people. So is it more about that than it is about pathogen avoidance? So the various people, I'm one of them, have different views about all of the things that we basically call disgusting. And I think that pathogens are a fundamental part of it, but not the whole story.
What determines the different thresholds of disgust in different people? I think you will find that, you know, as you kind of negotiate daily life, there are some people who are more easily disgusted than others, who find a lack of cleanliness more affronting, for instance. What determines that? Why are some people more easily disgusted than others?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right that people vary a lot in how disgusted they are. And there are a number of scales, one of which John Haidt and Rick McCauley and I have authored, but there are others, which measure individual differences in disgust sensitivity, and they're considerable. So there are people who will eat almost anything and very rarely experience disgust, and other people who find all sorts of things disgusting, things that most people don't. So there's no question that there's that difference. Now, where does that difference come from, is what you're asking, and we don't really know. There is an inherited component to that, it tends to run in families, even with children who are adopted out. And it's more similar in identical twins, but most of it is not accounted for that way. So we don't really know why people differ in disgust, but they certainly do. Now, there is some, the pathogen view would predict that people who are more likely to experience pathogens, say, for example, people who live in tropical areas might have a higher disgust sensitivity. And that may be true. I don't think we know that really.
That was Paul Rosen, a psychologist. If you'd like to listen to the full interview, you can look it up on our website, bfm.my. Just search for The Evolution of Disgust.
I can't believe you just go a psychologist. It's not just a psychologist. It's basically the leading researcher in the psychology of disgust.
That's true. Sorry. So earlier today, our intern also went around the office and asked some of our colleagues what gives them that same visceral reaction of disgust. Here are some of, you know, what some of them had to say.
Snake. It's because of I can feel it when it's like gliding through my skin and it's like cool, and for me it's awful and I don't like it.
Rats. I don't like rats. Like every time, even if a rat inches closer to me, it makes me very uncomfortable to think about their tail and then their furriness.
I have an irrational fear for is cockroaches. I know like deep down there's nothing that they could do to me, but it's just, I don't know, it's just, it's very hard, it's almost impossible to explain.
I think one of it is, I don't know what exactly called trypophobia or something like that, which is like those tiny little holes in the body, like bugs, like you have like the maggots coming out of your body and all that really freaks me out. Flying cockroaches, but that's a universal fear lah. I think everyone should be scared of flying cockroaches.
The one main thing that got to me is usually moths. I have this huge irrational fear of moths. When I see them, I freak out. I just lose it, man. When I see a moth, I just can't.
So it's interesting when you think about what makes something disgusting to different people, right? I mean, Paul, the psychologist from the clip that you heard previously, used food as an example. And when we think about what makes food disgusting, we can tie it back to the pathogens. Mm. But when you think about his example of incest, the disgust is not derived from a pathogenic fear, but it's just the action and what it could result in.
Yeah. So, you know, if you look at the fear of clusters, you know, of holes and bumps, for example, or trypophobia, that actually evolved as a way to avoid infectious diseases. So thousands of years ago, if you saw a person covered in boils or a body covered in flies, a natural aversion to the sight would have helped you avoid catching, you know, whatever it is that they had. So even though that is not necessarily the case today, yet people still fear it. And, you know, most of us who fear it were not alive thousands of years ago to make an emotional connection to seeing a body covered in boils or flies.
According to a Gross Word Investigator in his 2013 article, the linguistic formula for a disgusting word is to make sure it contains phonetically abrasive letters like B, G, M, U, and O. Mm-hmm. So words like bigly can sometimes elicit, I don't know.
I mean, bigly, I feel like that's tainted by other things.
Right, right. Okay, sure.
Bigly.
But take the word moist, for example. Paul Thibodeau, a professor of psychology at Oberlin College in Ohio, found evidence to support a new theory that that moist is hated not for its phonetic properties, but for how it makes us think of bodily fluids or foul smell. Vomit, phlegm, discharge, mucus, and you know, others said that these words remind them of sex. So feeling disgusted can be derived from actually so many different things.
That's true. I mean, the word moist doesn't bother me as much as it bothers other people, but I think seeing a visual of something and hearing that word is what makes it worse. So doing research for this made me realize just that, you know, that I get grossed out with pretty much everything.
What grosses you out, Swen?
Slugs. I had
okay.
to pick up slugs multiple times throughout my life. I did not enjoy it. I used way too much tissue paper than it's good for the environment, probably.
I think the word that gets me all the time is smegma. Not going to explain it, but I'll leave you with that. Sorry?
I mean, I just have to say, if any one of you have never seen what a Suriname toad is,
yes,
right,
you should really see it.
You should see it.
Or
but,
not.
But warning, if you have very bad trypophobia, you'd probably want to stay away from that.
Yes.
Absolutely. So we've been discussing the BBC story about the Spanish slugs invading central Moscow and how it brought out disgusted reactions from some. You can share with us what disgusts you. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or call us 7733-2900. We'll get to your comments right after I'd Rather Go Blind by Etta James. For now, BFM 89.9.
The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It's the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture. This hour, we've been discussing whether our local fruits are at risk of being forgotten. We spoke with Zoe Rai of Zoe Bangsa about some of the efforts to ensure that that doesn't happen.
And on social media, we've received quite a few comments. So we have Muhammad Chani Abdullah WhatsApping in the fruit karanji, which is something that I've never heard of before.
I love karanji. Love it.
I mean, I've never tried it or heard of it.
So we had to do a bit of Googling and realize that that's a black fruit.
And I've promised that I'm going to try to bring some back when I go back to my hometown.
We also have a couple of WhatsApps in about star fruits. So Nini says that star fruit is rarely seen nowadays. And Maggie also WhatsApped in to say that back in the 60s, the star fruit was a must for visitors from Singapore or a gift which Malaysians bought when visiting relatives or friends across the causeway. So, yeah, I mean, you mentioned that earlier, right, Kelly? You don't see it often anymore.
Exactly, yeah.
We also have one last comment about this. Vasudevan says that Malaysians have forgotten to be Malaysians when it comes to food and fruit and coffee. We love aping the orang putih too much.
Harsh. Oh, harsh.
Yes. And on a completely unrelated note, we also discussed disgust. Or more specifically, why some of us feel grossed out about certain things that are seemingly harmless.
We also have a few comments on that. So on WhatsApp, Cheryl WhatsApped in to say that images of pimples being popped is what grosses out the most.
The thing about that is that, yes, it is gross. Pimples are gross. I mean, when it's being popped. But at the same time, there's also this element of satisfaction that kind of overrides that disgust. So you will go and watch these pimple popping videos being squirmy, but also satisfied at the same time. It's quite conflicting. Emotional ride.
I can completely relate to that. That's how I feel. Like, it's so gross, but I just want to see more.
Yeah.
You still watch that video. So Lily also WhatsApped in to say quite a few things, actually. So frogs, insects such as worms and maggots, cockroaches, and also the word vomit.
Vomit, I think. So, yeah, I can't see vomit, I will throw up. It has that reaction on me since I was younger. I can't, that's why I said, doing research for this has made me realize that I'm pretty much afraid and grossed out by everything.
A whole range of things.
Exactly.
All right, so we've come to the end of the hour. Thank you everyone for taking part in our poll and for sharing your thoughts. If you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcasts on bfm.my/dailydigest on our BFM app or look us up on Spotify. Coming up at 3 p.m. is Front Row. Sharmila Ganesan speaks to the people behind a contemporary dance showcase that brings together dancers from the UK and Malaysia. And later, a special By the Book episode dedicated to Harry Potter in honour of Harry Potter's birthday week. So we'll leave you with Harry's Code by Knox Brown on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.